course.
So first of all, thanks for doing this. You were the first person I thought about when I thought about doing an episode on The Shining. And
I love that.
And this is, I'm sure, the first of many episodes with you, because there's a lot of movies that you're perfect for. But I wanted to kick off with this one, and I didn't even realize until you mentioned it just before we started recording, 40th anniversary of The Shining. It did not even occur to me. So
that's right.
All the better. What was your first encounter with this film?
I believe I was introduced to the film from the iconography that kind of came along with it when I would go to stores in New England, like Newbery Comics. I would always be looking at posters, trying to find my favorite bands. And there would generally, in these kind of stores, be some stuff from like Reservoir Dogs or Goodfellas. And one prominent image that I always remember scrolling through on that poster rack was that image of Jack Nicholson coming through the door. And it sort of became like burned into my psyche. Like, what is this? What is this movie, The Shining? It sounds so cool. And again, I was probably 6 or 7 years old when I would go to these stores for the first time and buy a White Zombie shirt or a Nirvana In Utero shirt. And I always wanted my walls to be covered in really cool posters. So that was my introduction to it through that image. And being an avid slasher fan at the time, discovering my love for the genre by going to, Blockbuster or sort of mom and pop video stores, I eventually was allowed to rent The Shining. And it was the first time I had seen a horror movie that was more a psychological thriller, filmed in sort of a way that was a bit avant-garde. I was used to the more straight kind of John Carpenter or, Sean Cunningham slasher archetypes. And this was the first time that I was introduced to that sort of off the beaten path style of filmmaking. And I just remember really loving it. And it's one of the few ones in the horror genre that's like that, that I really love, because I am more of a slasher guy in general. And I just remember sort of being blown away by it. And here we are 40 years later, still talking about it. So clearly they did something right.
40 years later, which is just totally bonkers. What's interesting is for me on my end, you mentioned that you were familiar with and already enamored with and a fan of slasher films. I grew up loving horror movies from about age 11 onward, and The Shining, for whatever reason, remained a gap in my film viewing history well into adulthood. And I was, I'd seen clips of it on television. Like you, I was aware with the iconography, and I thought it looked cool. And I knew, here's Johnny. I knew the cast. I knew who the director. I knew who wrote the book. You have so much cultural awareness sometimes when you're immersed in pop culture that there are some films that you feel like you've seen, and then you realize you haven't. And it was actually, and again, I had seen chunks of it, and if you were to do like a forensic investigation of my memories, you could probably piece together somewhere in there the whole film or close to the whole film. But the first time that I, with intention to watch the movie from start to finish, wasn't until just a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago. Yeah, and there was Cinespia, who does a lot of those great screenings at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery and at different theaters around LA. They did a Shining holiday screening one December at a theater in downtown LA, where they had made it up to look like the Overlook Hotel during the New Year's party.
Wow.
And people came dressed, I wore a suit and whatever. And so you really got into the whole thing. And they had little rooms with photo ops where there was, a vintage typewriter with all work and no play, like in the pages, and a tricycle you could sit on and take pictures on, and, red rum written on bathroom mirrors. And it was very cool the way they did it. And being, a fan of Kubrick's films in general and of horror flicks and feeling like I knew The Shining, it was just mind-blowing to sit in a theater, full volume, a really great print, and just go into it, start to finish. And then it was like, okay, this is, first of all, this is the way I needed to see this movie. I wish it would have happened sooner, but everything happens for me. But yeah, it's become one of those things where, you know, I was watching a Red Letter Media video the other day where they were talking about Cobra Kai, and one of the hosts was saying he watched all of Cobra Kai season one or two, and then went back one and two, and then went back and watched the Karate Kid movies because he'd never seen them. And then he said, you know, I'd never seen the first one, but he's like, it's kind of like I had. He's like, I knew Sweep the Leg Johnny. I knew Crane Kick. I knew Mr. Miyagi. He's like, that stuff's in pop culture. And while I love the Karate Kid and I've seen it a million times, I think that you could much more forcefully make that argument for a film like The Karate Kid than you can a film like The Shining. And that really only became clear to me actually sitting down and watching it from start to finish. You know what I mean? Where it was like, okay, yeah. I know all the beats and I know the basic story and I know a lot of history around the film, but it's just such an experience. And that's speaks volumes, you know, of course, of the performances in the movie, but it is a director tour de force. You know, if there's ever a time to use that cliche phrase, it's just visually so immersive and surreal. And it's not, you know, you might think you know these little scenes and everything, but those scenes then in the context, once you're soaking in the vibe of the whole thing, it's just incredible.
No, I agree. It's that tone that sort of permeates through the entire film, and just even how the minimalized musical score just sort of brings about and complements rather his descent into madness. It's like you can't appreciate that from just the sort of pop culture beats. Like you're right. You have to sit and view the film at its completion. And you know, I've watched a few documentaries about the making of it, and it you hear about Stanley Kubrick spending, you know, 13 months making this film, and that sounds, you know, insane. You know, I don't know how many films other than, you know, stuff like maybe Titanic or big James Cameron kind of stuff you would film that long, but you hear about how many takes he did. I think there was like one shot that was a close-up that holds the Guinness Book of World Records for number of takes he did. I think 148 takes of that close-up of you know, the chef talking to Danny about Shining, and you begin to understand when you watch the film, this guy was a perfectionist, and if he hadn't spent those 13 months, maybe we wouldn't be talking about the film today. And as an artist that you know, I consider myself like that, like a perfectionist, I really respect how sort of dedicated he was to his craft. And I also wonder, like, what was the deal he had with Warner Brothers to be able to have that freedom to do that? You know, usually there's like, you know, a production manager breathing down your neck about, oh, we need to wrap this up. And I guess Stanley must have been at that point in his career where he's winning so many Oscars, people are just like, this dude's just like, just do your thing, dude.
Yeah, you always wonder about that, especially, you know, when you think about how old Hollywood was really a producer-driven business. And, you know, you had stars that were, you know, contracted with the studios. And now, you know, with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you have kind of this producer-driven, again, where they hire great directors, but it all operates this larger narrative that's attached to the studio. And that's an example where it's been done well. But this idea of a Kubrick, like someone who's so self-contained and so confident in his vision and how to execute it. And to think about, you know, of course, 40 years later, we're still talking about this as this perfect film, which it is. But then to go back and read and realize that it wasn't received all that well when it came out, or that if you're a Stephen King purist, or if you're Stephen King himself, you thought it, like, you know, massacred the book. So, it, you know, time, obviously, viewing it through the lens of history and perspective, it's seen as a masterpiece. And I think the book is seen as an excellent work of fiction distinct from the film. Like, they're kind of, you know, separate. They're like, they're more cousins than adaptation. But, you know, it, like you said, to try to imagine what those conversations must have been. And given Kubrick's attention to detail and obsessiveness in all of his films, I suppose if there were any filmmaker who could be prepared for this, perhaps it's him. But the idea that there are so many theories and documentaries about the theories and films about the films and, you know, website rabbit holes to go down about what different things in the movie mean and why certain things are placed where they are. And I mean, it's just, again, speaks volumes of what a masterpiece it is, because you can't do that with The Karate Kid. Go using that as my go-to example of a movie I love, you know, but there are just certain things that warrant that kind of deeper study, and that always, you know, that have visual clues. And I think, you know, you mentioned the score. One of the other things that is most striking to me about the movie is the idea of the environment as a character. You know, right. I mean, it's not quite Amityville Horror House, where it's, you know, but it is,
yes,
in a bigger way, it's that whole, even without the supernatural element, the way the hotel is a character, the way the maze is a character, the way those long drives up the mountain in the snow, it's like those are all, it feels so alive, you know, and there's so much dread and tension just from the locations. I find that really fascinating about it.
No, absolutely. It's a very good point. It's like the hotel is this entity, and you feel it getting sinister with every sort of turn of the tricycle. And I think it's one of those films where every shot, every cut, everything feels so intentional. And I'm sort of always blown away when I see that movie. It's not like, oh, I've seen this before. It's like I kind of usually pick up something new that I didn't notice, whether it's a glance or a certain quick cut. And yeah, I think it definitely changed the way that I think about horror. And I think it's so interesting, you know, you pointed out that when the film came out, it received negative reviews. You know, Siskel and Ebert didn't like it. A lot of people said, you know, it was disappointing in terms of what they thought that he could do with Stephen King's book, and that it didn't honor the book. And I mean, I was surprised to learn, and I only learned this recently, that it was nominated for 2 Razzies. I mean, that's insane. Wow. To me.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't know that. That is insane.
Worst director, worst actress, and it didn't win, but just
couldn't even win at the Razzies.
Yeah, couldn't even win at the Razzies. But, you know, just to think of a movie like that, when you hear The Shining, it's at least now it's looked at as such an important film. And I think it's looked back as one of Stanley's most famous movies and most influential movies.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting when you mention the Razzies is that Nicholson, obviously the star of the film, I don't know if this has changed, but I believe he's the most nominated male actor in the history of the Academy Awards, or at least he was as of a couple of years ago. And so, yeah, to think about that in light of how this movie was received when it first came out. I've got some notes that I pulled up from a piece that I wrote for MovieWeb about The Shining a few years ago, going into some of the facts and the mythology around it. Of course, we should talk about the contentious relationship between Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick, and why that's remarkable. Even, you know, it's like when I remember as a kid finding out that Robert Smith and Morrissey didn't like each other. like, why? But right. Oh, you're both so great. You should be like BFFs. You know, so it's like you have these two visionaries who are so incredible in their respective fields, and for them to not have the kind of mutual respect that you would hope for in a collaboration like this is disappointing. Apparently there was only ever one conversation between the two of them by phone. And this, you know, in terms of the things that fascinate me and that I'm interested in life, it sounds like the coolest conversation ever, because it was Kubrick and King talking about death and the afterlife and hell and, you know, ghosts and stuff like that. And it didn't sound like they saw eye to eye. And I suppose King was also, my understanding is he was against casting Nicholson because he felt that Nicholson's persona and other films that he'd made would tip the audience off too early to the descent into madness. You know, they wouldn't see him as a likable regular guy from the outset. And I think, if anything, time has proven that wrong, because, you know, you and I love this movie. It's been out for 40 years, and we're both, you know, given our respective ages, we didn't come in with any of that baggage. You know, we didn't see that film going like, oh, it's the guy from One in the Cuckoo's Nest or what, you know, like, and even some of the pop culture references that are in that movie, I would argue that there's probably generations of people who associate Here's Johnny with The Shining without even knowing about The Tonight Show. Without even realizing like what he's referencing in the movie. You know?
And I guess that you know, that's one of the most famous lines of the film, which was ad-libbed by Nicholson. And I guess Kubrick didn't even know what he was referencing. That's what I read. He loved the delivery, and he almost, you know, in post, you know, he could have easily not used that take because he didn't even understand what it was going to be referencing and whether people would get that joke or not. But it was just such a moment that he kept in the film, and thank God, obviously, because I think that's one of the
probably the most iconic moments. Yeah.
Yeah. Which wasn't obviously in the book.
Yeah. I would imagine. Yeah. And we know that Kubrick had plenty of takes to choose from if he didn't want to use that one.
Oh, yeah. I think he did the 3 days of filming that door scene, from what I understand, literally.
And I know, I would imagine part of King's apprehensions and reservations about it are tied to the fact that the book was so semi-autobiographical for him. You know, because he, of course, struggled with alcoholism and was a writer. And a lot of his work is semi-autobiographical or tied to places that he grew up knowing or loving. This one in particular seemed to have a lot of importance to him. What do you think about that alleged Easter egg where, I guess in the book, the Volkswagen is red, which was based on Stephen King's real red Volkswagen. And then in the film, they switched it to yellow, but there's kind of a throwaway scene where you see a crushed red Volkswagen.
And I've never actually heard about that.
Yeah, and there's like
a little swipe at it.
Fan theory that it was some kind of Kubrick jab at Stephen King. And on the one hand, it's like, well, that seems far-fetched. But then on the other hand, when you think about Kubrick's obsessive attention to detail, it's like, well, maybe.
It's possible.
Yeah.
Because I guess, as you said, that relationship was very contentious. You know, from a legal standpoint, you wonder, when you sell the rights to your own book, mm-hmm. I'm assuming that King owned the rights of the book. I wonder if there's some sort of language, contractual language, that allows you to not basically have final say in things. Like, I wonder where that comes down, because if you sell your own story, I guess you're giving up that right for it to be exactly as you imagined. And I think that's clearly where the beef began, because they both saw the project in very different ways. And I guess, you know, you understand from a writer's perspective, and especially as you mentioned, him having such a deep-seated connection to his characters, seeing someone take your creation and changing it to not how you intended it to be, I can see how that would be frustrating, but at the same time, it's like, at least it's someone who's regarded as an incredible filmmaker doing that. So
yeah. And I'm reminded that there's the famous Stephen King's dollar baby or dollar deal. There's a thing where there's an open invitation to student filmmakers, aspiring filmmakers, amateurs, that they can adapt any Stephen King story for a dollar. So there's like all these student films out there that are, you know, I think not the Lawnmower Man that we know that had nothing to do with this book, but there's a few that that he did that deal with, which is interesting. I believe, you know, there's something. I'm not remembering the details. Well, maybe I'll go back and add it into the show notes. But Frank Darabont and Shawshank Redemption, there's some kind of tie-in with that dollar deal, and Stephen King, some sort of anecdote about that. But yeah. To your point, yeah, you must give up some literal artistic license in those situations. My understanding is that years later, you brought up the legalities of it, in King's negotiations to reacquire the rights to The Shining, he agreed to stop disparaging the 1980 film.
Wow.
You know, he got it back and they did that miniseries that was more faithful to the book or whatever. And he stuck by that non-disparagement thing until after Kubrick died. And then he sort of went back to occasionally take
back in the train.
But there was, you know, there's some quotes from Kubrick about how he wasn't that impressed with the book and so on and so forth. But then there are other quotes from other interviews where he said very complimentary flattering things about the book. So, you know, maybe.
I mean, you would think, though, if he's picking this book out of a stack, that, you know, he must like it on a cellular level. But I think it goes back into, listen, these guys, too extreme at the time and still regarded now, two extremely successful, groundbreaking, sort of bar raising, legendary figures in their respective fields. There's, you know, there's ego that comes along with that stuff. And, you know, saying King's writing was weak, I guess is what I remember hearing them say. I think he was referring to Stephen King's screenplay adaptation, because I guess King was really excited at first, at least, that Kubrick was going to do the film, and he wrote the adaptation and sent to Kubrick. And I guess he said that was weak, but, you know there's got
to
be some
really important distinction to make. I'm glad you pointed that out. And I didn't realize that, because I'm a Stephen King fan. You know, this is no disparagement of Mr. King. His book has been important to me, and who I'm a fan of in general as a dude. I think he's pretty cool. But when he had the opportunity to direct the film himself, Maximum Overdrive, it was a horrendous piece of crap. So, do yourself a favor, if you've never watched it, go on YouTube and watch the trailers for Maximum Overdrive. Ooh. King appears in the trailer talking to camera to the audience, selling the movie in between clips of the movie. And it feels like cocaine on film. it's bonkers. I don't think he's proud of it either. And that's a movie that had like some cool visuals and had that Green Goblin semi truck in it. But yeah, not a great film. And I would imagine that some of the filmmakers who have been, where King's been critical of their adaptations over the years, could then point to that and go, you know, it's kind of like the rock music critic where it's like, well, why don't you make an album?
Yeah, stay in your lane.
Terrible.
Yeah. Right.
So maybe there's some of that. Maybe his, you know, the book's great, but the his attempt at a screenplay perhaps wasn't so great.
I may have watched pieces, but I never watched the made-for-TV miniseries. Was that good?
I never saw it either. Yeah. You know, I remember the reviews were pretty mixed. You know, it was a lot like when they did the Dune miniseries, where Dune fanatics were like, you know, David Lynch film isn't faithful enough and changed too many things and whatever. And then people got excited because it was like, they're doing a Dune TV miniseries. And then,
right,
you know, for different reasons, I think those really faithful adaptations weren't great. I mean, you know, one of our mutual favorite movies, my number one favorite movie, and probably a different episode that we'll also do together, is The Crow. And I think The Crow is a great example of something where the source material is cool, but the changes, adjustments that came through the scriptwriting process, and then some of the directorial choices, and then things that ended up on the cutting room floor sort of unintentionally, and I'm thinking about the Skull Cowboy character in particular.
Right.
It all worked to make a perfect movie, to where, as much as you could argue, a faithful adaptation of James O'Barr's original Crow comics would be a cool movie, I don't think it would have been anywhere near as cool as the movie we got. So it's not always a case, you know, I say this as somebody who grew up reading comic books and had to suffer through a lot of crappy comic book movies before we started getting good ones. But it's not always a case of like, just make the thing that's on the page. It's perfect.
Right.
Like, no, sometimes it you know, it can use some creative input from the filmmaking people. Especially if they're Stanley Kubrick.
Absolutely. The way I kind of look at it, the way you were describing that, it's like, you know, if, you know, what's a seminal album? You think about like Nevermind or something. Mm-hmm. If Nevermind had been made maybe just the way Nirvana had wanted it to be made, maybe it wouldn't have been as incredible without, you know, Butch Vig's input. So it's like kind of that channeling of another voice, of an extra set of eyes and ears on something, especially when you're transferring it to a different medium that, that, as you said, maybe gave us something that would have been better than just a straight faithful adaptation of the book.
Yeah. And I think that probably counts for a lot of things. There's a great comparison to be made with music. You know, there's a producer that writes all of your songs for you. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about somebody who helps execute your vision while bringing something to the collaboration, you know, that
right,
brings out the best of what you created. And I think that's what a good adaptation, the best adaptations can do. I mean, and then to even, you know, not to go into a tangent about the Marvel movies, but one of the things that works about them is the way that they take the essential elements of these myths and distill them so they work as movies, where it's like you get, you know, it's like the thing in the Bible about the spirit of the law versus the letter of the law. You know, you get the spirit of the law with these Marvel movies. It's not a fundamentalist reading of the text, but you know, I love George St. Pierre as Batroc the Leaper in that little scene in Captain America: The Winter Soldier. I don't need him to be in the ridiculous purple and brown, orange, whatever costume, jumping around, bragging about how he does savant or whatever. You know, it's like, I like the way that they did it. And they did it in a way that took the elements of that character, but made it work. So to me, this film is not only a perfect example of what we're talking about. This takes it, I think, even a step beyond to where it's such an important piece of art, almost independent of the book. You know, it's just its own thing.
And I think, you know, to touch on what you had mentioned before about Stephen King not agreeing with some of the casting because people would have preconceived notions about Jack Nicholson, I think Kubrick, part of his genius is that he wasn't looking so short term. I think he was, when he was making a film, he would make the film to stand the test of time. I think that's what I gather from a work like that, because as you had said, like, we weren't aware of, you know, we're in a generation where we weren't so aware of Nicholson before. I think that was probably my first film that I ever saw with Jack Nicholson, maybe that or Batman, the first Batman. And I think that, you know, he could see in the grand scheme of things that, okay, well, maybe some people initially, you know, maybe Stephen King's point about that casting affected those initial reviews, But what's most important is how the movie has been looked at over the course of 40 years. And I think that it's a testament, the changing of the guards in terms of people receiving the movie now as this brilliant work of art, I think is a testament to Kubrick having that sort of perspective and realizing that it's not about in the moment right now, it's about how this piece of art is going to affect on a long grand scale and a long-term thing.
And that's one of the best books, the best albums. They all come, you know, they're of their time in to the extent that they can thrive in the context of the culture around them, but they're timeless in that they're made sort of in a vacuum that's independent
yes.
of kind of immediate concerns. Yeah. And you know what, to your point, I think The Shining was probably my first knowledge of Jack Nicholson and who he was, like the first thing I ever associated him with for sure. And then, yeah, I saw the Tim Burton Batman movie at the drive-in as a little kid. And I knew him as like, he's that guy from The Shining, though I hadn't seen The Shining.
Right.
You know, so right. Yeah, to your point. And I would imagine, you know, my dad, who just turned 81 a couple months ago, I would imagine for him sitting down and watching The Shining in 1980, he knew who Scatman Crothers was, you know, and it was like, right. Oh, there's Scatman Crothers. And it's like, I only vaguely understand that he was this whole other thing outside of The Shining. I just think of him as his character in The Shining, you know?
Absolutely.
So yeah, you make a great point that Kubrick was able to see past those immediate associations and have clearly a long view for how this would play out. I'd read that prior to Nicholson being cast, that Kubrick considered De Niro, which is interesting, and Robin Williams.
Yes.
It's really interesting.
Really interesting.
And the same year, I don't know if it was filmed before or after, but the same year, Shelley Duvall and Robin Williams made Popeye together, where he was Popeye and she was Olive Oil.
That's so they right. Did end up making a
wildly different movie.
And you would think about, you know, if Robin Williams had been cast in that, how that would have changed the trajectory of his career. And I feel like Robin Williams, by the end, really, you know, sort of made that Bill Murray leap where mm-hmm. it's like, or even like you think about like a person like now, a Jason Bateman, in terms of you start in comedy, you're known for comedy, but you're so good at your craft that you can really pull into those other kind of characters and not be typecast. Yeah. And I could see that working. I could definitely see De Niro of doing a great job. I know Harrison Ford, I guess, was considered at one point.
I've seen that somewhere.
Christopher Reeves too.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, but
immediate thought is he was too tall.
He's too tall, right?
I'm trying to picture him coming up the stairs.
And too muscular. I feel like, you know, Superman. I think that the only one that I could really picture in it other than Nicholson would be De Niro, but. That character is so sort of ingrained in the psyche of pop culture. Jack Nicholson, it's really hard to imagine anyone else giving that unbelievable performance that character so rightfully deserved.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it is interesting in the What If universe to think about how Chris Reeves' career would have changed and what a pop culture inversion and subversiveness, you know, flipping the audience's expectations would be to put him in The Shining, you know, what, 3 years after the first Superman somewhere. Superman would have been out already by 1980. That's interesting because that would be the exact opposite of what King was worried about.
Right.
Him is nothing but this great, virtuous, wholesome, all-American guy.
Right, so I feel like almost the De Niro casting probably would have rubbed King the wrong way as well. Because
yeah.
De Niro, you know, was already sort of known as that sort of, he could play something crazy or terrifying. But the Robin Williams and Christopher Reeves, and I guess even Harrison Ford, you know, would have had that sort of against type kind of thing. Yeah. And I think, you know, the only thing I could think of Harrison Ford as a villain was What Lies Beneath. I think that's the only film that horror, at least horror film, where turns out to be.
He's either in later years just there, or, you know, swashbuckling, charming, and heroic, even when he's broke, you know. So, yeah, you don't see him much in that. I mean, you know, to the great Robin Williams, rest in peace, to his credit. Of course, he won an Oscar for Good Will Hunting, one of my favorite films ever. But in terms of the darker sort of villainish stuff, Insomnia, the Christopher Nolan movie.
Right.
And with Al Pacino, it just... incredible. And that's another film that has a Kubrick level, I would say more so than Nolan's other work, that immersion that I felt watching The Shining in a movie theater, where Insomnia made me feel like I was experiencing all the same like psychological phenomena that Al Pacino was. There's something about the way that film's put together where you start feeling like you're in Alaska with the sun shining.
I've never seen it.
Half asleep. Oh, man.
Never seen it.
Well,
have to check it out.
For sure.
Here's my homework.
It's good. And I suppose, you know, obviously when we think about Christopher Nolan, we think about Memento, we think about the Batman movies. But yeah, that was Insomnia kind of snuck in there. I want to say it was this movie after Memento. I actually got to see him do a Q&A that was a screening of, I think it was Memento and Insomnia at some film festival. And it was incredible hearing him talk about that. But yeah, but that was an opportunity where Robin Williams really got to play a darker, nuancey, menacing kind of character after seeing him really, you know, act his heart out in Good Will Hunting. And then there were always rumors. I want to say it would have been with Tim Burton. Had Tim Burton continued on and made Batman Forever, that Robin Williams was the, you know, person that supposedly had the Riddler role in the bag.
I do remember hearing that. That would have made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I could have seen that too. But yeah, like you said, man, I love considering those what if scenarios where it's like the movie worked out exactly the way it was supposed to and it's perfect. And then there's these realms in the multiverse where Robin Williams starred in The Shining.
The alternate realities, like it reminds me of that movie, actually one of my favorite comedy action movies, Last Action Hero, Arnold Schwarzenegger is playing a fictional character and you get trapped inside of that fictional character's universe and they go to the video store because the kid's trying to prove him, no, you're a famous action star. And you see the Terminator poster in the background, but I think it's Sylvester Stallone is right, Terminator. Yeah. And so you always think about those sort of what-if moments and sort of strokes of fate and stuff like that.
Yeah, I always love their friendly rivalry. I think it's in Twins when Schwarzenegger walks past a Rambo poster and Stallone's like shirtless and he's all oiled up. And Schwarzenegger looks at the poster and then looks at himself and then he's like,
That's awesome.
They always took those little, like, they were friends, you know, so they always took those little funny jabs at each other.
Jabs. I didn't know that. I always love hearing that. I always love hearing those stories more than the beef.
The actual
I always like
beef.
The mutual respect.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like the mutual respect instead of the drama bullshit.
Me too. So we definitely can't do this episode without talking about your personal creative collision with The Shining. I mean, not only obviously having done a song about it, but let's talk about your whole experience, how you came to know the Kubrick family and how you found yourself at the Kubrick estate.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty interesting of a story. It was our first time ever touring in Europe. And at the time, the band wasn't in a position where we were getting, you know, great offers. So here, come and support this large act over here, because you know, when you're coming to a different country for the first time, that's the optimal way of doing things, opening up for a established act over there, because you don't know if anyone cares about the band yet. So after years and years of not getting those kind of offers at the time, we decided, hey, we're just gonna headline over there. No one's gonna take us. We're just gonna go out there and do it ourselves. And I was tasked with finding openers for the tour. So I would get submissions from our European agent on different bands, and this one group in particular called Shields from the UK. They struck me as a cool band, and it sounded great, heavy but melodic. So we took them out, and we got over to the UK and became very friendly with them. And we had a day off before our show in London, and the guitarist, vocalist, Sam, a very nice guy, said, hey, you know, come and stay with us. You guys don't have anything to do on the day off. We said, sure. I mean, you know, on tour, especially in an unknown country, you get an invitation to someone's house. It's like, that's a great thing, especially when you're an up and coming band and maybe can't afford, you know, great accommodations in London. So as we're going there, as we're driving outside of London, we start to get more information about where we're going. And our tour manager had known Shields before this tour. And as we're going there, he says, well, you know who Sam is, right? The guitarist for Shields. Like, yeah, he's a nice guy in Shields. Like, well, he's actually Stanley Kubrick's grandson. And we're going to stay at the Kubrick estate. And I'm like, are you messing with me? Is this a joke? So we start approaching this long, long country dirt road. And we start getting into this estate. And I'm not just talking about like one building. I'm talking about like 10 different buildings, full staff, probably, you know, 20 to 30 staff. It's called, I don't know how it's pronounced, but Childwickbury Manor, and it's in Hertfordshire. And we sort of couldn't believe it. You know, we get there, and Sam kind of explains, yeah, this is my grandfather's estate. And he takes us to the barn area where the band was to stay, and explains to us that this is where his grandfather actually used to edit the films. And we were staying in that barn area where he cut The Shining, and we looked around. He said, yeah, you know, have free reign, go dig through boxes, whatever. He's just such a nice, gracious host. And, you know, I found like the original audio reel from Full Metal Jacket. He took us around the actual large mansion, main house, the manor house rather, of the estate where Stanley lived. And in one room, there was all the masks from Eyes Wide Shut hung up on the wall. He took
it's like,
us.
It's into like being stadium. Allowed into a museum after hours.
Like, exactly. Out.
Yeah.
It's like a personal, you know, like a VIP experience, you know. Yeah. And we saw Stanley's personal library, which was obviously very impressive, with one of those ladders that you see in big libraries that slides, you know.
So you
get up to like the different shelves.
Like Belle in Beauty and the Beast.
Exactly. That whole thing, you know, the award for 2001 Space Odyssey, all of his awards. And it was just such a great experience. And we met his family, met his father. And Stanley, of course, died, you know, in 1999. And he's actually buried on the property.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
And it's just, it was nice to meet the family. And they were just so kind. And just had a very warm relationship with them, and ended up, for years to come, we would store our gear for European tours at the Kubrick estate. And they were nice enough to hold our gear so that we wouldn't have to ship it every time we went and played in Europe. And, you know, months after this event, I had this idea. We were between album cycles, and I said to myself, let's let the fans pick what book, because at the time we were basing everything on books, what book they'd want us to do next. And I put it between, I think it was between Psycho and The Shining, and The Shining won. So we wrote a song about The Shining, and I thought, oh man, we're friends with Sam now. He's got such a cool scream. Let's get him on the track. So shot in the dark, asked him if he'd like to be a part of it, and he was totally into it. And I wrote the lyrics around knowing that he was going to be a part of it. Like I tied in like this bloodline lyric, so it would, you know, and it just gave the song this gravity to have someone who was part of the Kubrick bloodline involved in the song. And it was just a really cool experience.
It's so incredible. And you know what I love about that story, and it speaks volumes about, I know I've used that phrase like four times today, but it speaks volumes of your character and who I know you to be as a dude, that relationship wasn't built on anything other than just good old fashioned camaraderie. You know, you liked his band, you guys were hanging out, he invites you to stay. You know, if you had sat down and created a master plan to try to ingratiate yourself with the Kubrick family, couldn't have pulled it off like this, you know? Like, and I just, I love that. I love those kind of stories in life because I find them reaffirming in a sense that like, oh yeah, sometimes like good things just happen to good people because the good guys do the right things. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those days when you can get cynical and feel like cool things only happen to devious evil people who connive ways to make them happen, you know? So
yeah,
I like it for that reason alone, let alone, you know, all the other directions it goes. So a couple other things I want to talk about before we wrap up. So there's, should we talk about the American Indian genocide or should we talk about the moon landing?
that's the theories.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, we can have a very surface-ish discussion about those. But yeah, one of the big theories, and it's in that documentary, Room 237, is that The Shining was done as a confession because Kubrick needed to get it off his conscience that he had faked the moon landing for the U.S. government in exchange for access to NASA technology for 2001. There's a couple of different directions in which that theory doesn't work for me. One of them being, well, if NASA wasn't capable of getting to the moon and that was all fake, what sort of awesome technology did they even have that he would need? That to me is just like the first part that like the card in the house of cards that falls over. But I mean, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories, the ones that aren't, you know, QAnon or the ones that aren't hurting anybody where nobody's gunning up to go defend them, I think can be fun. So, you know, maybe, let's see, I know there's the Danny Torrance was wearing that Apollo 11 sweater at one point. There's like all these circumstantial clues where people are like this, he was communicating that he did it. So I guess my question to you would be, have you seen that documentary and what do you think about that moon landing theory?
You know, when it came out initially, I was really excited to watch it. And then as I remember starting it, I just thinking that this is like just batshit crazy. And I don't think I even finished it because of that reason. It just seemed so bizarre. And the one I think you described might be the most out from left field thing, or there was something else about the Illuminati or something. It's just, it's fascinating to me. And again, I think it, as we use the phrase, speaks volumes about what they created with Stephen King and Stanley, what they did together. They created this story that was so powerful and that I think feels so important and so intentional that it breathes these kind of theories. And I think you only get that.
Study. Yeah.
Right. As you said, it wouldn't maybe get it from, you know, no one's watching Karate Kid and say, is Mr. Miyagi's shirt, is it buttoned at the top as a reference to, you know, I don't know, one of the wars or something, or a kamikaze pilot. I have no idea. But I think it's very interesting to listen to the theories. Some of the stuff I remember from the documentary, I didn't even understand what the woman was talking about. I remember there was one part where she was saying that, you know, they referenced skiing in the office scene. Jack Nicholson was asking about skiing. And then when the Grady twins are looking at Danny in one of the rooms, or like there's that scene where they appear in the room together with him, there's like a poster that can be seen in the background that looks like a ski ad, but it turns out to be something else. And just a bunch of question marks went up in my head. Like, what the hell are they talking about?
What are we talking about right now? What's happening? Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of that. You know, it reminds me of one of my favorite criticisms that I saw about a commentator once, which was they described the person as confusing having thoughts with being thoughtful. And that's how a lot of this stuff strikes me. Like, we have a lot of thoughts about this Shining and this conspiracy theory. It's not, that doesn't qualify as thoughtful.
No.
Have thoughts.
Yeah.
So this other one, I'm actually going to read this little paragraph. And I wrote it like 2 years ago, so I'm plagiarizing myself, even if I don't remember. But this was about American Indian genocide. So there was a guy named Bill Blakemore, and he wrote an article called Kubrick's Shining Secret, Film's Hidden Horror is the Murder of the Indian. And this was published on the front page of the Washington Post in 1987. He was an ABC News TV correspondent, and he contended that, quote, every frame, word, and sound of The Shining was about the genocide of the American Indian. The evidence for his theory includes the presence of the Calumet baking powder cans, the Indian motifs that decorate the hotel, and the bit about how the overlook was built on an Indian burial ground. He went on to say that the 4th of July party and the very name of the hotel, I just realized I said New Year's party earlier. For the July party and the very name of the hotel, Overlook, were meant to symbolize how America overlooks the crimes committed against Native people, just as audiences would overlook these clues.
That's pretty interesting. I mean, I don't know if I buy into it, but it's a well-thought-out bullshit.
Yeah, it seems more plausible than the moon landing confession.
It does. And I guess the Native American motif on the hotel is an interesting thought, but it's embarrassing. But in the actual film, because I get confused, because the Overlook exteriors were shot in Oregon, right? The it's based off the Stanley, which is in Colorado. And it's film interior.
That's the place that King actually stayed for
that, right? So right. It is supposed to be in Colorado, right? Yeah,
I think so. Right? Yeah,
I don't know if it's ever explicitly mentioned, but I'm assuming that's what it's supposed to be.
You know what? I never remember what state they're talking about either. But I would assume, since Colorado was the Stanley, no relation to Stanley.
right. Exactly. King.
Which was allegedly haunted. He stayed there in 73, and he wrote the book in 77, I think. This, of course, was in 1980. But yeah, I guess there's been like ghost hunting episodes and things like that down there. Do you know much about the Stanley Hotel? I don't know much.
We were actually on our fall tour last year. We were invited to come and play an acoustic set at the Stanley Hotel.
Okay.
Yeah.
And forgive me for not knowing this until right now. I've seen the acoustic set. I was aware of it, and I knew that it's set at the Stanley Hotel, but I didn't make the connection that it's the actual Stanley Hotel. You know what I mean? I thought you
just did
like
crazy.
Live at the Stanley Hotel, and you just like went somewhere that kind of looked like it, and some set dressing. I didn't realize it was like a real. That's amazing. Well, tell me about that.
It was crazy. Yeah, it was a really wild experience. We were in the midst of a radio campaign for one of our songs, and uh, we you know, our label and management were actively in touch with many of the radio stations promoting the single. And during that whole tour, we would do a lot of morning radio performances where you come and you play acoustic in the morning, which can be very difficult. Hey, at 7 a.m., yeah. Just to sleep for 2 hours on a bus, coming and sing a song with some high notes in it.
And listen to our wacky morning DJs.
Yeah, exactly. And one particular station in Colorado, KBPI, I think is what it's called, they were nice enough to invite us to play at the Stanley Hotel. They had done some events in the past, so they flew us out. We played one show. I think we played maybe in Salt Lake or something. And then the band and a few of our crew members hopped on a plane. They flew us out to, I think, to Denver. And then we were taken in a car and driven to Estes Park, Colorado, where the Stanley is. And they put us up, the band up, in these beautiful condos. Like, there wasn't room in the hotel, but they put us up in these beautiful condos, just, you know, on the property. And we had amazing accommodations. We played a set. There was only 200 tickets available. Small, intimate show, sold out really quickly. And we got to play in that hotel. And it was really a wild experience to get tours of the hotel and hear these stories about, you know, room 217. We went up to the room. It's 217 in the book as opposed to 237 in the film. And that's the room where Stephen King stayed. And one of the coolest and unexpected things about the whole visit and about learning about the Stanley Hotel is that one of my favorite comedies was filmed at the Stanley Hotel, Dumb and Dumber. So that
wow.
So that's supposed to be the hotel in Aspen where they go. And so as soon as I heard about that, I was researching on the way. I was like, oh my God, this is it. When we got there, I was like, you know, you see Harry and Lloyd walking up those stairs with their boots, getting out of the Lamborghini. You go into the bar. It's the same exact setup that the poster of, you know, speaking of the moon, when he's like, we landed on the moon, that poster was there. And I guess that was just an ad lib that Jim Carrey made in the end of that scene. And, you know, we got a lot of stories about the paranormal activity that had been thought to have existed in the hotel. There was a woman who was staying in the hotel who was just standing in the hallway for like an hour because we kept passing her. And she was just holding up her phone to an empty hallway, obviously trying to record some sort of paranormal activity. But they told us that Jim Carrey requested to stay in 217 because he's a big fan of Stephen King and The Shining. Right. And apparently awoke in the middle of the night, ran out of the room and told the people at the front desk, get me out of this hotel, I'm not staying here. Whether the story is true or not, that's what they told me.
I love it.
I thought that's pretty funny. And it was just all in all a great experience. And I highly recommend checking out that hotel. It's beautiful. And it's obviously in just a sort of pristine location in Colorado.
This part of the conversation is making me want to go hunting for that miniseries from the 90s, because I believe that they shot the Stephen King faithful TV miniseries at the Stanley Hotel.
They did. They did 100%.
Now I'm like, well, maybe I do want to watch it. I just remember reading that it wasn't very great, but
I think, you know, you think about visually what you're going up when you're making that movie, because everyone has it ingrained in their mind that Jack Nicholson is Jack Torrance and the axe coming through the door. And it's like, how do you compete with something that is so widely just pop culture, you know?
Yeah.
How do you compete with that?
And I think it took this long to make what looks like, you know, fingers crossed, a great Dune film, sort of for that same reason, because while Dune purists weren't fond of the David Lynch movie, it was still a David Lynch movie. You know, like, it looked really cool. The casting was
right.
It had a great vibe. It had a great sound. It had Sting in it. You know, Sting is one of the Harkonnens or whatever. And like, that was, you know, you still have that image of the David Lynch Dune in your mind whenever they try to do a Dune TV series that was probably like, you know, a tiny decimal point fraction of the budget.
Right.
Now finally it looks like they're doing Dune, doing right by Dune. So is that
in production now or pre?
Yeah, I'm not sure what stage of production, but they just like recently, maybe a week ago, I'll send you a link. They just dropped a trailer for it.
Awesome.
And the cast is massive. It's got Oscar Isaac, Jason Momoa.
Oh wow.
Kirsten.
Who's gonna be Eric Draven, who was very close to playing Eric Draven.
Yeah, him and Bradley Cooper, Jack Houston, the guy who played Richard Harrow in Boardwalk Empire. There's been a lot of great actors attached to that role, but you just don't touch it. Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff I'm not precious about where it's like, look, you know, a remake or a soft reboot or whatever, it doesn't change my relationship with the original. But there is just something, there's some kind of magic. There's just something that you, there's something sacred. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, sacred, I agree.
With the crow that you can't recreate.
Did you enjoy that cursed film documentary on Shudder?
Yeah, you know, cool. The thing that I really appreciated about it is somebody who's been obsessively following The Crow for all of these years, did an oral history about it for MTV for the 15th anniversary. Some of those Polaroids that the makeup guy had that were like his continuity Polaroids, I'd never seen those before. And those were in that episode and they were like high res. And at some point after that episode, those showed up on the internet. And I was like, okay, this is new Crow material to wet my whistle. I'm pretty excited about that.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, so listen to this. The Dune cast is Timothée Chalamet, Rebecca Ferguson, Oscar Isaac, Josh Brolin, Stellan Skarsgård, Dave Bautista, Stephen McKinley Henderson, Zendaya, David Dashmalian, Chang Chen, Jason Momoa, Javier Bardem. It's a pretty big ensemble.
Wow.
There's a lot of Marvel and DC people in there.
So there's like an insane amount of hype behind that film.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. And I think they, the director is the guy who did the Blade Runner sequel, Dennis.
Oh, wow.
However you say his last name. Villeneuve. Kristen.
Yeah.
That's my default when I can't pronounce a name. But yeah, Hans Zimmer score, like big budget.
Wow.
Fingers crossed. But speaking of sequels, that's the last thing I wanted to talk about quickly is, did you see Dr. Sleep?
I did. And I sort of got wind of it much time before I think it was even announced to the public that it was happening through another interesting Ice Nine Kills connection. On our song Love Bites, I had met this girl through my girlfriend Nadia, and her name was Chelsea, and she was an actress and she had done some stuff, and she came out to visit us in LA one night. And we went to like the Saddle Ranch or something on Sunset, karaoke bar where sometimes you end up after you're out way too long. You know what I mean? It's one of those like last moment, oh, let's go to Saddle Ranch. Yeah. And she sang an Alanis Morissette song. And I was just like blown away. I was like, man, this girl is amazing. So when it came time to do our song Love Bites, we needed a female voice on it. I thought, let's get Chelsea. So she recorded the vocals and she killed it. That song was based on American Werewolf in London. And she ended up getting a small role in Dr. Sleep. She's that girl that Ewan McGregor sleeps with after he's hanging out with her in the bar.
Sure.
So, and she shows up.
The one with the kid, right? Like,
I think so. I only saw the movie once, but it's like in the first trailer, you see her like super dead looking with like the dead eyes and like the crusted over face. So she appeared in the movie. So she told us a long time before it was even announced that she had just wrapped filming on this Ewan McGregor movie, and it was a sequel to The Shining. So I really did enjoy the film.
I did too.
For me, it's like that the most exciting thing for me is when they go back to the Overlook and you're just looking around like, man, they nailed the aesthetic of this. Like, this is what it really would look like 40 years later or however in the future it was supposed to be.
And I love that they brought back the Scatman character, which obviously the actor passed away many, many years ago. But I thought they did it in a way that was respectful. You know, it wasn't like one of those weird CGI facsimiles.
It looked just like him, though. But it was amazing casting. Yeah. It was incredible.
Yeah.
And apparently that the original actor. What was his name? He's the famous musician, right?
Scatman Crothers.
Yeah.
I just keep calling him that because I don't remember his character's name.
Dick.
Halloran or something like that.
Something like that. He was just supposed to be a wonderful, wonderful human being, and I've seen interviews with him, and like to the point where he's like in tears about. These are tears of joy because, you know, I'm just having such a great time making this film. But yeah, Dr. Sleep was really cool. And Ewan McGregor's fantastic actor. And I think they did a really good job.
That was another thing, I guess, that's different. One of the main differences between the book and the film is the Dick Halloran character doesn't get killed in the book.
Right.
So
I think they needed that extra sort of axe moment where he was axing for it.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's a sad moment because you really liked that character.
Indeed. And then we did get to see him on the other side in Dr. Sleep.
Right.
Yeah, and Dr. Sleep suffers from that same insurmountable iconic status of The Shining. That I just went into it going like, okay, I'm going to think of this as something that's connected to The Shining. I'm going to think of it as more connected to the book, and you know, and just try to separate it from those impossible expectations. And I think I enjoyed it that much more as a result.
Yeah. I think also it's like, I don't think that to me, the name of the book, the name of the movie isn't so great. It's like, you know, you think about The Shining, it sounds like this, like, iconic piece of IP and Dr. Sleep, like I get what they're doing with Doc and stuff, but it doesn't have the same ring to it to me. And that might be like a, you know, just a subconscious thing because of The Shining, but I feel like if the name had been different, it might've found more success theatrically. Cause I don't think it did that well. Did it?
No, it didn't. And you know what? Even if they would have done something that was like of The Shining, or you know, not call it The Shining 2 necessarily, but put like, you know, the way they did Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, you know,
right,
something like that, where more of a direct tie.
Yes, because I think it was exactly because I think that there was a large percentage of the population out there that didn't realize that it was the sequel, and I think if they had been a little bit more heavy-handed in a tactful way, in a way that wasn't just like, okay, we're just Shining too. Like if they had put some more thought into that, I think it would have found more of an audience.
You almost wonder if the marketing intentionally shied away, and as a result, almost sort of overcorrected, you know, and not wanting to be exploitative of the connection to The Shining, downplayed it so much that they downplayed it into non-existence.
It's possible. I mean, I knew right when I saw the trailer because, you know, we're horror fans that it was connected. Yeah. And obviously those shots, I think it was the red rum at the end, like definitely nail in the coffin for, okay, this is obviously connected to The Shining. But yeah, I think that may have been a slight misstep, but it was such a well-made film. I'm sure it'll continue to find
its audience. Find an audience, I think. Yeah. And great casting. Great casting that movie all around.
Great casting, yeah.
Well, Spencer, this has been fun. I knew it would be. It's everything I thought it would be. So
thanks for having me. Yeah. It's always a good time talking to you.
Perfect. Yeah. And I would, I've got a list of movies I want to do, musicians talking movies. And, I just keep putting your name next to a bunch of them. So
well, I appreciate that.
the more you want to come back, I'm happy to have you.
Count me in.
Awesome, brother. Well, be safe and I'll chat with you soon.
You too. Take care, man.